Nahum chapter 3. We're going to read the entire chapter. I'm going to be reading to you from the NIV. It's just on certain texts of scripture, just so much clearer. It's like, you know, it just saves a lot of time. I just start there, read there. That way I don't have to go through all of the vocabulary issues. So follow along with me. Nahum chapter 3, beginning in verse 1. Woe to the city of blood, full of lies, full of plunder, never without victims. The crack of whips, the clatter of wheels, galloping horses and jolting chariots, charging cavalry, flashing swords and glittering spears, many casualties, piles of dead, bodies without number, people stumbling over the corpses. All because of the wanton lust of a prostitute, alluring the mistress of sorceries who enslaved nations by her prostitution and peoples by her witchcraft. I am against you, declares the Lord Almighty. I will lift your skirts over your face. I will show the nations your nakedness and the kingdoms your shame. I will pelt you with filth. I will treat you with contempt and make you a spectacle. All who see you will flee from you and say, Nineveh is in ruins. Who will mourn for her? Where can I find anyone to comfort you? Are you better than Thebes, situated on the Nile with water around her? The river was her defense, the waters her wall. Cush and Egypt were her boundless strength. Put and Libya were among her allies. Yet she was taken captive and went into exile. Her infants were dashed to pieces at every street corner. Lots were cast for her nobles, and all her great men were put in chains. You too will become drunk. You will go into hiding and seek refuge from the enemy. All your fortresses are like fig trees with their first ripe fruit. When they are shaken, the figs fall into the mouth of the eater. Look at your troops. They are all weaklings. The gates of your land are wide open to your enemies. Fire has consumed the bars of your gates. Draw water for the siege. Strengthen your defenses. Work the clay. Tread the mortar. Repair the brickwork. There the fire will consume you. The sword will cut you down. They will devour you like a swarm of locusts, multiply like grasshoppers, multiply like locusts. You have increased the number of your merchants till they are more numerous than the stars in the sky. But like locusts, they strip the land and then fly away. Your guards are like locusts, your officials like swarms of locusts that settle in the walls on a cold day. But when the sun appears, they fly away and no one knows where. King of Assyria, your shepherds slumber, your nobles lie down to rest. Your people are scattered on the mountains with no one to gather them. Nothing can heal you. Your wound is fatal. All who hear the news about you clap their hands at your fall, for who has not felt your endless cruelty? So tonight we come to the end of this prophecy given by God through his prophet Nahum to the city of Nineveh, the capital city representing the entire nation of Assyria. I've tried to make sure that we understand that this prophecy would be like God prophesying to America, but doing so through the city of Washington, D.C. That's the reason this is addressed to Nineveh. They are the capital city, the representative of the entire nation. So don't misunderstand. This is not just about a city. It's about the entire nation. And as we talked about last week, it's obvious that this is an example for all nations that would have the same mindset and fall into the same way as this Assyrian nation. So far in this prophecy, we have seen the Lord Yahweh himself. We've seen his greatness and his goodness, and that the Assyrians' crimes were committed against him. We learned that back in chapter 1. So that being the case, he tells them through Nahum that he will deal with them through their kings, through their leaders. He will deal with them personally. He will deal with them face to face. Even though God had been merciful and good to them in the past, yet now they had turned against him. They had turned against God's people. They had rebelled against him, and now he was against them. But even though we have seen some inferences of the crimes of the Assyrian nation, they have not been clearly defined until now in this last chapter. Which, as we can see in verse 1, this last section of Nahum's prophecy is a prophetic woe, which basically means when God gets to this point, when he declares a curse upon you or a curse upon a nation, he will not turn back. He is a God who is long-suffering. He is a God who is great in mercy. But there is a point in which he will not turn back. He will not relent. So here, God gets specific with this nation, as we've been seeing through this example of Assyria. He's getting serious not only with this nation, but with any nation like her. Any nation that has been previously blessed by God, previously given his great mercy, but then that nation turns against him. So here he details their crimes against him in this last section, and he basically lists three indictments along with its punishment. And it's important that we see these indictments. The first indictment is in verse 1. Let's read it again. Woe to the city of blood, full of lies, full of plunder, never without victim. Okay, so what's the first crime? What's the first crime described in those words, in the picture that he gives us? A city of blood, a city that's full of lies, a city that's full of plunder, never without victims. What's the first crime? It's the crime of oppression. Oppression. This nation was guilty before God of oppressing people and other nations through the violent shedding of blood. The Assyrians were infamous for it. They oppressed people. Notice God lists three things here. They oppressed people through death. They oppressed people through lies. He says they're full of lies. So they oppressed people through deception. And they oppressed people through depredation. They were full of plunder, never without victims. So they oppressed people through the plundering of their victims' goods. Their wealth, as we saw last week, it's described as limitless. That's how rich this nation was. Their wealth was limitless, but their wealth was built from and upon the backs of those that they conquered, those that they oppressed, from and upon their endless line of victims. What a picture this is of a nation. Basically, it's this. To be involved with this nation in any way, even voluntarily, was to become its victim. To be involved with this nation was to become its victim. Okay, church. So by now, as we are becoming students of the minor prophets, we've worked our way through several so far, surely we ought to be able to see by now that God hates oppression. He hates oppression. This very thing fueled his anger in nearly every prophecy we have studied so far, and it will be the same as we progress through the rest of these minor prophets, and then even in the major prophets, we see the very same thing. God hates oppression. I want you to think about something. God created human beings to rule over his other creation, right? He made us in his own image. He gave us dominion over his other creation. He created all of his creation for us, for human beings. But hear this. He never created us, since we are created in his own image. He never created us to rule over one another. Or he never created us to rule over one another in an oppressive way. He never created us to rule over one another by violence, by death, by deception, by depredation, which is really covetousness, all of that came after he created. All of that is a result of sin and the fall and self, the self. That was never God's intent for us as human beings, for us as his crowning work of creation. That was never God's intent for us. He never created us to rule over one another in an oppressive way. When God gives us position of rulership, position of leadership, position of headship, individuals and even nations, it is not to oppress, but to care. It is to care and to provide for. Really, it is to love over, not to lord over. And I want you to think about that. In every position each of us may have in our life, and we can spread this out to nationally too, it should be that way. If America would really be a great nation, this would be the example that we see, that we would see. I want you to think in every aspect of leadership or rulership that you have been given in your life, is it marked by oppression? Or even in places where you may have to have a strong arm, do you do it to oppress, or do you do it to care? To actually care for people. To actually love people. To actually care for that person's soul. That's the difference between ruling oppression, which oppressing through rulership, which God never intended it to be that way, and having a headship or rulership or leadership God's way, which is love, caring for the soul, caring for others, loving others. Now, I know that takes on many. Sometimes love is not a, you know, huggy-feely type thing. Sometimes it's hard, but at the root, it has to be love. It can't be oppression, which is rooted in pride. Okay? If we look at another person and we think that they're worthy of being oppressed by us, one thing is for sure. We have a far too high estimate of ourselves. We have taken the place of God. Even God himself does not rule over his creation in an oppressive way. Now, does he judge? Yeah, and he's right to do so. But he reigns on the just and the unjust. He gives good gifts. He cares for all of his creation. We are created in his image. Even in the fallen world where people hate God, he still cares for them. Even when they rebel to him to his face, he still cares for them. Even when they deserve his just wrath, there's an aspect in which he still cares for them. He's mercy. He's long-suffering. As his God, he has called us, church, to declare the gospel to the whole world, to a world full of fallen sinners. You can't care for people any more than that. That's what God has done. That's what God has done. He has never called us, he never created us to rule over one another in an oppressive way. He created us to love over one another and not lord over one another. God hates oppression because it's rooted in pride. It's rooted in arrogance. And God will repay a nation for it. We see that clearly right here. Then notice the punishment alongside this first indictment. Look at verse 2 and 3 here. The crack of whips, the clatter of wheels, galloping horses and jolting chariots, charging cavalry, flashing swords and glittering spears, many casualty, piles of dead, bodies without number, people stumbling over the corpses. You see God's punishment? God repays a nation. This is national here, so we have to look at this nationally. God repays a nation for oppressing and victimizing its people and other nations. He repays them with military defeat. He repays them with military defeat. That's the language here. That's what all these horses and cavalry and all the bodies piled up and the stumbling over the corpses God repays a nation for victimizing its people and other nations with military defeat. Really, he repays them equitably. They become victims. They are oppressed. God hates oppression, and he will repay it with the same. He will repay it with the same. Then the second indictment is in verse 4. Look at verse 4. All because of the wanton lust of a prostitute, alluring the mistress of sorceries, who enslaved nations by her prostitution and peoples by her witchcraft. Here God indicts Assyria for not only depredation, but degradation. He pictures Nineveh, he pictures Assyria here as a seducing prostitute who is out to spiritually and morally degrade the entire world. And I thought, obviously that's the picture of that, but I thought about, well, where is it in God's word that we could see a clearer picture of this, in specifically in the nation of Assyria? Well, listen to Rabshakeh, Assyrian's captain, as he spoke to Jerusalem for the king Sennacherib again. His words do a pretty good job of defining, of giving us a picture of what this second indictment is all about. Listen, in Isaiah 36, verse 13, he says, "Then the commander stood and called out in Hebrew, 'Hear the words of the great king, the king of Assyria. This is what the king says. Do not let Hezekiah deceive you. He cannot deliver you. Do not let Hezekiah persuade you to trust in the Lord, to trust in Yahweh, when he says, Yahweh will deliver us. This city will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria.'" The inference there is Hezekiah can't deliver you, and Yahweh can't deliver you either. That's what he's saying. "Do not listen to Hezekiah. This is what the king of Assyria says." Listen to what he says about the king of Assyria. "Make peace with me and come out to me. Then each of you will eat fruit from your own vine and fig tree and drink water from your own cistern until I come and take you to a land like your own, a land of grain and new wine, a land of bread and vineyards. Do not let Hezekiah mislead you when he says, 'The Yahweh will deliver us.' Have the gods of any nations ever delivered their lands from the hand of the king of Assyria?" In other words, the king of Assyria is greater than all. The king of Assyria is really the god of gods. Here, the seducing lies of Assyria. That's the seducing lies of Assyria. "Come on out to us. It's going to be great when you come out to us. Well, you're just going to have everything you ever wanted." Well, after we kill your babies and you know, all sorts of other atrocities and enslave you in our carry you out of your home and enslave you in our land and make you our slaves to serve us. Lying, seduction. And the punishment along with this indictment, look at verse 5 through 7. "I am against you, declares Yahweh Almighty. I will lift your skirts over your face. I will show the nations your nakedness and the kingdoms your shame. I will pelt you with filth, with dung. I will treat you with contempt and make you a spectacle. All who see you will flee from you and say, 'Nineveh is in ruins. Who will mourn for her? Where can I find anyone to comfort you?'" The punishment for her whoredoms is God will expose her. God will expose her. He will expose her lies. He will expose her wickedness, and all will know her shame. Remember, this is how God repays a nation for this lying seduction. Okay? He will expose them. Then finally, the third and last indictment, look at it in verse 8. "Are you better than Thebes, situated on the Nile with her water around her? The river was her defense, the waters her wall." Remember, Nineveh was surrounded by a moat. So he's lining up the defenses of the city of Thebes with Nineveh's defense. "Cush and Egypt were her boundless strength. Put and Libya were among her allies." The city of Thebes was surrounded by their allies, so was the city of Nineveh. Yet she was taken captive. Yet she went into exile. Her infants were dashed to pieces at every street corner. Lots were cast for her nobles, and all her great men were put into chains. So here God sets this third indictment before them in the image of the ancient Egyptian city of Thebes. And just by the description here, we can see that this city of Thebes had impenetrable defense or moat around it. It was, like I said, surrounded by its allies, both like Assyria itself, but yet it was still conquered by its enemies. As great as it was, as solid as its defense was, yet none of that could stop it from being defeated and conquered by its enemies. And here's the thing, the Assyrians knew all about this, and they knew all about this great city. They knew all about the fall of this great city because they had conquered it. They had conquered it. They had bashed their babies, their infants, to pieces on the street corners. They did. They had bartered for their leaders for slaves. They had carried out the inhabitants of the city as exiles and imprisoned their mighty men. And the point, the indictment here from God, Assyria had become so full of themselves, they had become so arrogant that they failed, they even refused to learn from the past. They failed to and refused to learn even from their own past, the very past that they were involved in. And this is a great crime. It is. You know what? We can't change the past. We can't change our own past. But we can sure and we better learn from it. We better learn from it. That is, if we are humble enough to do so. Do you know that we are so full of ourselves that we refuse to learn from our own mistakes? Individually and nationally. How many times do we beat our head up against the wall making the same mistakes over and over and over again? You know why? Because we're so full of pride to actually humble ourselves and learn. Look, that was really dumb what I did. I was dumb. I was stupid. I was ignorant. Man, I didn't know anything. I'm not doing that again. We better learn from our past if we are humble enough to do so. I thought about this, an illustration of what's going on right now. It's more of an illustration. It's really quite telling. All of this about removing historical landmarks that's going on in our nation right now. Now, let me just state that I get not wanting to memorialize evil. I get not wanting to make heroes of even men. Sure, we all ought to get that. We all ought to. But is that really what this removing of these historical landmarks is all about? Or is it that we really don't want to? Actually, we refuse to be reminded of the kind of evil that resides within us. Are we refusing to be reminded of the kind of evil that resides within us individually and nationally? I mean, we have America's past all prettied up and perfumed. It ain't all that prettied up and perfumed, y'all. It just ain't. I know we think, and especially the religious right, okay, we think that all the forefathers, they were great Christian men who always did all that was right. That is not true. Church, most of the forefathers, we wouldn't give them a letter of membership in this church. That's just the fact. We picture all that stuff, pretty all that stuff up, when really, that's a refusal to admit and acknowledge how evil we can really be. Let me just throw this out there. You know, if anybody's got a right to gripe, in the multicultural state of our nation, it's some Indians or Native Americans. They got a real right to gripe, okay? That was not just Christian behavior that happened with our forefathers and the Indians. Okay? And we can name a bunch of other things, but we kind of don't want to look back at all that. I think it is because we don't want to be reminded of what kind of evil can actually reside in us and what actually has and does reside in us individually and nationally. And really at the very foundation of it, you understand right now, America is nowhere near Christian. They even refuse. I mean, in the public school system, it's illegal basically to teach anything but evolution. Evolution is a direct assault against God, our Creator. That's a direct assault. It's people who hate God, who hate God Yahweh. It's a direct assault. So really, here's the thing. If we admit and we acknowledge that there is evil, by necessity then, there must also be good. You understand what I'm saying? If we say, yes, there is absolute evil, if we look back and we say, that was wrong, then the other side of that is that there must also be good. Since there is absolute evil, what's the opposite? There has to be an opposite, right? There must also be absolute good. And if there is absolute evil and there is absolute good, there also must be God Himself. Work that out in your mind. Work that out. Understand the reality of absolute morality and absolute immorality prove God Himself. That's the reason in the postmodern age that we live in, by the way, now they're calling it post-Christian age that we live in, that's the reason nobody wants absolute truth. You know, your truth, there's your truth and my truth, but no real truth. You know why? Because when you have absolute morality and absolute immorality, absolute good and absolute evil, of necessity there must be God. That in itself points to God. When I first started hearing about all this, remove this monument and remove this flag, I just marked it up as more asinine stupidity, the stupidity that we are becoming more and more renowned for. But maybe really it's a sign, it's a testimony of our growing arrogance and rebellion against God. That's really what it is. I can tell us this, to God Himself, this refusing to learn from our past, this refusing to learn from our past history, it may well be a marker of the great sinfulness of national pride. Because in this text, among God's indictments here, this kind of national arrogance in which they refuse to learn from their past, right here, it just really seems to be the last straw for Assyria in this prophecy. Let me just give us an overview of the great punishment that follows this indictment here. One by one, in verse 11, this nation, this kind of nation, the Assyrian nation for sure, but we know that this is an example. This kind of nation that is so filled with national arrogance is this seducing deceiver, is victimizes, oppresses its people and everyone else around them. This nation in verse 11, especially here following in the punishment of this particular indictment of this refusing to learn from their history, this nation will not be able to stand. As full of arrogance as they are, they will not be able to stand. But God tells them they will stagger and fall like a drunk man. And that staggering and falling is under the wrath of God. In verse 12, this kind of nation, again, these punishments line up with this last indictment. This kind of nation in verse 12, all of their defenses, as great and as many as they may be, will all fall. Verse 13, the language here in verse 13 is all the men, but what it means is all the strong. All of the strong will be killed or carried away from this kind of nation. In verse 14 and 15, all attempts to recover security will end in the opposite. It will be a labor of futility. Build back up the walls, strengthen it back up, pull yourselves together. No, it won't work. In verse 16, for this kind of nation, all commerce, all business will end. Verse 17, all military is gone. Verse 18, all leadership is gone and all the population scattered. Verse 19, complete, impending, inevitable destruction, total devastation. And as icing on the cake, which is just really so telling of the real reality of such a nation as this, when this total destruction, this total devastation, when the wrath of God comes upon such a nation, at the end of 19, look, the rest of the world will be glad. The rest of the world will have a party. Wow. And we might say, well, that could never happen to us. All of the things that are listed, that can never happen to us. Yeah, that's pretty much what Sennacherib sent to Hezekiah too. That can never happen to us. You need to bow to us. We won't be bowing to you or your God. So it's a sad indictment. And to make it even sadder, all of this came upon a nation that had previously received the mercy and the blessing of God. All of this came upon a nation that God Himself even used in His plan and for His purposes. If they had only reverenced Him, if they had only remembered Him, if they had only not rebelled against Him, if they had only walked and were ruled by humility instead of pride and arrogance. If only. So, you know what? This kind of preaching is not so much fun. And I'm sure hearing this kind of preaching is not much fun either. And especially so when we can look at these indictments and this punishment and these punishments against a nation like this and see that we, America, if we are not as a nation such as this, we certainly are quickly becoming a nation just like this. I want to hold out hope. But it's getting harder and harder to hold out hope. It really is. And if we are a nation such as this, this being the case, as we come work our way through this text, we can see that apart from the mercy of God, this also will soon be America's end as well. Remember how it all winds up? Complete, impending, inevitable destruction and devastation, and the rest of the world has a party at our demise. If this is the example, and we can see shadows and pictures of ourselves nationally in this example, it's easy. Math is pretty easy. 1 + 1 = 2. The end for Assyria will be our end as well. And yes, God will provide for His people through such an event, such a judgment as this, but His provision may not be quite what we have in our minds. In other words, God may give us what we want or what we need and not what we want. Or at the very least, let me put it this way, this kind of punishment and wrath upon America for her crimes will absolutely alter all of our lives as we know it. Drastically alter all of our lives as we know it. So this kind of preaching is not pleasant, and it's certainly not popular either. Now, that's the reason we can barely find the minor prophets in our Bible without an index. That's the way it is. It's not popular. But what about the prophet? What about the prophet? Is this kind of preaching profitable? Well, yes. First, because it's profitable because this is preaching God's word. This is not my message. This is God's message. We have the prophetic books on purpose. We have the prophetic books intentionally. It's my duty to preach this book and to draw the meaning of the Holy Spirit, of God Himself, through the prophets out of this book and then apply it to us. And it's really, to be honest with you, it's pretty easy to apply because we see ourselves in these indictments so clearly, nationally. So that being the case, the prophet here for us living in today's America that we can see looks a whole lot like this nation here on the cusp of God's impending wrath. And by the way, God did exactly what he said in 6:12. Exactly. He did exactly what he said. The nation has never recovered. Never recovered. So the prophet, our takeaway, the truth that should be applied by this prophecy to our minds and our lives, what is it? What's the truth at the bottom line? Let me just give us a few. Number one, we cannot trust in ourselves. We cannot trust in ourselves. Listen, the events of this world and even in our own nation are so much bigger than you and me. You can't trust in yourself. You don't live on an island that far away from everything to trust in yourself. You cannot trust in yourself. Number two, we cannot trust in our possessions. We cannot trust in our wealth. According to the prophecy, even if it's limitless, I don't know about y'all, mine don't fall under that category. But still, whatever it is, you cannot trust it. You cannot trust in it. Understand something. You and me, we do not own any earthly possession that is not going away. I've been undergoing an intense lesson on that. I've been working almost a year now on an old car, 55 years, it's just a little older than me, 55 years old. And you know what I've been doing for a solid year? You know what I've been working on this car for a solid year? Rust. Rust. It's going away. And even though I'm putting it back together and taking care of that the factory never even thought about taking care of, it's still, if it makes it another 55 years, long after I'm gone, it's still going to rust again. It's going away. It's going away. You or me do not own anything that is not going away. Plus, you or me do not own anything that cannot be taken away. Nothing. There is a real sense in which all of our earthly possessions are just a facade. Do you know that? Do you understand that? It's just, there's a sense in which it's pretending. If they don't leave you, you will leave it. You know, you've heard it. Nobody's buried with a U-Haul full of their stuff. You're buried alone in a casket. And your stuff belongs to somebody else. That's the reality. There is a real sense in which all of our earthly possessions are just a facade. We cannot trust in them. Number three, we cannot trust in our nation, the great America. It is great. Listen, we are still, it's on a downhill slope, but we still live in the greatest nation on the face of the earth. I believe that. But we can't trust that. How quickly it can change. Overnight. We cannot trust in America. We cannot trust in our nation. We cannot trust in our leaders. We cannot trust in a president. No one man is going to recover our nation. Matter of fact, if that one man is able to do that, our nation has already left what it was founded upon. It was made so no one man could rule the nation. It was built like it's built, so no one man could rule the nation, but it could be ruled by its people. So listen, if one man can recover the nation, then we've already lost. We can't trust in a man and a president, especially the kind of men and politicians we are more and more accustomed to desiring. I mean, listen, I know y'all are seeing some of the same ads and stuff that I'm seeing every night in inundating everything that you might watch and listen to media-wise. I'm just going to be honest with you. there's one party in this political thing. I don't understand how they got nominated. I really don't. I don't understand. How could America really want that? It's baffling to me. We can't trust in our nation. We cannot trust in our past reputation. We cannot trust in our past reputation, nor can we trust in our present power, in our military might. We can't. Greatest nation on the face of the earth was taken down by a nation that they didn't even dream of them taking them down. And this is not the only place that's happened. No. So the prophet is seeing America so clearly in this prophecy. What is the prophet? As we see these things, we cannot trust this. Obviously, we can't trust that. This is what they had, that didn't do them no good. This is what they had, this, and that didn't do them no good. What's the prophet? As we see this, it ought to drive us to the focus of this prophecy himself. It ought to drive us just as fast and furiously as we can go to the God of chapter 1. God, Yahweh himself. It ought to drive us to the greatest and the highest and the sure and faithful refuge to all who trust in him. Salvation from this, rescue from the wrath and destruction that America is certainly bound for. Only God, Yahweh himself, only he can save us. He can save us. Saints, hope in the Lord. Hope in the Lord. Put all your faith, put all your trust in him. And come what may, like Job said, even if he slay you, serve him. Even if he slay you, trust him. Trust him. Put everything else second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and him first. Him primarily. Trust him. Everything else will fail you. We were talking earlier. Haven't you? If you've got any age on you at all, I know there's some younger people here. You're going to learn these hard, hard lessons, and they're hard. And it's one of those lessons you keep beating your head up against the wall. But if you've got any age on you at all, haven't you learned by now that nothing of this world satisfies? Nothing in this world can truly fulfill you. Nothing. Only the Lord God himself can do that. That's how we're built. That's how he created us. Because the greatest end of man is to know God and enjoy him forever. And if we don't know God and we are not enjoying him forever, I guarantee you, you are unfulfilled. You are unfulfilled and you are looking everywhere else right now today to find something or someone to satisfy you. And it ain't on this earth. It ain't in the things of this world. It ain't in the nations of this world. It's in the Lord God himself. That's it. Trust him. Chapter 1, verse 7. Yahweh is good. A refuge in times of trouble. Y'all, we're in times of trouble as a nation. He cares for those who trust in him. I think it's pretty apparent our nation is past trusting in God. But are you? Are you? He cares for those who trust in him. Trust in the Lord.